What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Shaul Majid, author of American Post-Judaism, Identity and Renewal in a Post-Ethnic Society. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@Yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. A new survey by the respected Pew Research Center came out last week, and the organized Jewish world is in an uproar. It demonstrates that American Jews today don't seem to connect with their religion much at all, and that many younger American Jews, when asked what their religion is, simply reply, none, but they say they're Jewish. While this new Pew survey found far more Jews out there in America than the last National Federation survey did, 6.7 million American Jews as opposed to 5.2 million in the last National Jewish Population Survey conducted in the year 2000, the Jews it found were less connected, less observant, and even less likely to reproduce, all of which has prompted predictable responses from the usual suspects in the Jewish world. Rabbi Jack Wertheimer, the American Jewish History Professor at JTS, the Conservative Seminary, and an advisor to the Pew Studies, said, "I don't know how to spin this report as being a good news story. It's a story of a community that's contracting." While Rabbi Rick Jacobs, head of the Union for Reform Judaism, wrote, "Although the results are open to varied interpretations, the data include much good news for Reform Judaism. More than one-third of all U.S. Jews identify with the Reform movement. 55% of Jews who were raised within the Reform movement stay within the movement. At the same time, 11% of Orthodox Jews and 30% of Conservative Jews switch to join the Reform movement," he said, among other positive observations. "And the share of the Jewish population that is Orthodox is actually growing and will continue to do so because of a very high Orthodox birth rate, in spite of the fact that many Orthodox Jews do leave Orthodoxy, perhaps 50% of all of those born into an Orthodox environment." While all the noise over this survey is rattling around the Jewish internet, a few key observations are worth making. First, the numbers game. I must admit to some puzzlement as to why, in this day of instant national polls on every single subject, it takes 3 years to correlate data on the Jewish community of America. The National Jewish Population Surveys of 1990 and 2000 also took something like 3 years to make final reports. And this one is based on data from the year 2010. I understand. It took Moses 40 years to reach the Promised Land, but when you can see the results of polls instantaneously, on every subject from football to politics to entertainment, I don't really get why it takes so long to figure out how many Jews there are and what they say they believe and do. Anyway, a couple of days before the Pew survey came out, Brandeis University released a study that also said that the 2000 survey severely undercounted the Jews of America. While the 2000 National Jewish Population Study said there were 5.4 million Jews in America, we now apparently have 6.7 million Jews, or 6.8 million, according to Brandeis, roughly 1.8% of the American adult population. There are an additional 1.6 million Jewish children. Of those who identify as Jews, 4.2 million say they are Jewish by religion, while the remainder consider themselves Jewish by some other means, culture, heredity, culinary preferences, who knows? Beyond these total population numbers, a few salient facts emerged from the survey. They weren't too surprising to the highly intelligent listening audience of Too Jewish, but they may be news to some. First, there's a definite generational trend away from belief and affiliation among American Jews. Members of the so-called Greatest Generation, so named by Tom Brokaw, this means people who grew up in the Depression and fought World War II, are 93% likely to define themselves as Jews by religion. Only 68% of millennials, those born after 1980, are apt to describe themselves like that. 75% of all American Jews say they have a strong sense of belonging to the Jewish people, while 70% say they identify strongly with Israel. 73% say that remembering the Holocaust, in whatever way, is essential to their Jewishness, an interesting statement. Most encouragingly, 94% of Jews in the U.S. say they are proud to be Jewish, including, get this, 83% of those who say they have no religion, but they're proud of it. Next, a few other items were striking in the survey's responses. 69% of American Jews say that living ethically is Jewishly essential to them, while 56% say that working for justice and equality is. And while 43% say that Israel is central to their Jewish identity, 42% say that a good sense of humor is an essential part of it, while only 19% say that observing Jewish law, halacha, is. In other words, John Stewart has more Jewish followers than the Lubavitcher Rebbe, at least on Twitter. Among the other Pew Report findings, for those Jews who have married since the year 2000, 60% are intermarried with non-Jews, continuing a long-standing, even rising, trend. Of greatest concern to those who care most about the future of the American Jewish community is the decrease in religious connection, which has proven over time to be the only real guarantee of long-term Jewish meaning and commitment. The affiliation rate among millennial Jews is much, much lower than among older Jews. That trend does not appear to be changing or slowing, even when they have kids, in spite of various initiatives aimed at reversing this tendency. All in all, there is nothing terribly new in this survey, but it's a confirmation of trends we've been seeing for a long time. My personal take is that much of the emphasis in Jewish world programming has been directed at creating non-religious ways for Jews to connect with Jewish ideas or events. The problem with this approach, and the large amount of Jewish money that it has absorbed, is that it's failed to connect younger Jews with anything that actually contributes to retaining them within the Jewish community as actual Jews. The end result of these efforts is that younger Jews retain positive feelings about Jewish identity, humor, even Israel, without really doing much that will connect them to meaningful Jewish community going forward, and without helping them raise their own children as active, participating Jews. It's fascinating to me as a congregational rabbi to see the huge amount of effort, talent, and money expended on community building outside of, even deliberately away from, the one place that continues to do more to establish the Jewish future than any other, the synagogue. Had we invested a fraction of the time, effort, and money being poured into other kinds of Jewish identity creation, instead into invigorating our temples and Jewish schools, we would be in a vastly stronger position as a community going forward. It is what has made Chabad a truly dynamic force on the Orthodox side of things, and it is what continually limits us in the liberal Jewish world. If Jews merely identify with humor and food, there isn't much to say that 50 or even 20 years from now there will be a dynamic Jewish community in this golden American diaspora. If Jews identify with prayer, study, practice, communal support, and social justice, defined as liberally as you wish, there will be a great future for our people here. And all the surveys in the world will just continue to confirm this, as I believe they already do. These surveys of we Jewish descendants of Abraham, Avraham Avinu, lead us into our play-in on this lovely fall morning. Here is the Sephardic classic, Quando Re Nimrod, also called Avraham Avinu. It's a kind of a circumcision song about Abraham's own Brit Milah. The refrain is, Abraham our father, our beloved father, blessed father, light of Israel. Sung in Ladino, the classic language of the Mediterranean Jewish world, by Israeli Moroccan singer Yehoram Gaon.
Quando le reni mirò dal campo salia, mirava e nel cielo e in la estreria, vido luz santa en la giuderia, che havia de nascer Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu, padre querido, padre bendito, luz de Israel. Avraham Avinu, padre querido, padre bendito, luz de Israel. La mujer de Terah quedó preñada, día en día le preguntaba, ¿de qué tenés la cara tan demudada?
Ella sabía el bien que tenía. Abraham vino, padre querido, padre bendito, luz de Israel. Abraham vino, padre querido, padre bendito, luz de Israel. Quando il re Nimrod dal campo salia, mirava nel cielo e la estreria, vide luce santa e la giuderia che aveva de nascere Abraham avino. Abraham avino, padre querido, padre bendito, luz de Israel. Abraham avino, padre querido, padre bendito, luz de Israel.
That was Quando Ere Nimrod, the classic Sephardic song for Abraham, our great ancestor, on a week when we begin reading his story in temple with the Torah portion of Lech Lecha. More about that a little later. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll meet our guest, Professor Shaul Magid, who's in the Jewish Studies program at Indiana and has written a book that explores Jewish identity in a post-ethnic society. Why will people stay Jewish when they don't have to and many of the old ties are broken? Find out when we return on Two Jewish. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Professor Shaul Magid. His book is about Judaism in a post-ethnic world. Tell us what that means.
Well, for the last 30 years or so, most people that look and examine American religious society and culture have talked about this concept that we all know called multiculturalism, which is, in a sense, not only a tolerance of diverse ethnic groups, ethnic minorities, but also ethnic and cultural minorities, but also a celebration of those ethnic and cultural minorities. And what's been happening in the last, I would say, 15 or 20 years, I think, is that we seem to be moving toward a transition from that multicultural world. And one of the reasons is that multiculturalism is an idea that requires a certain kind of stable ethnic anchor. That is to say that people, by and large, identify primarily with their own ethnic group, and then have other identities as well, either professions or, they're fans of sports teams or increasingly sexual orientation and so on. And what's increasingly been happening largely as a result of a number of factors, one being inter-ethnic marriage in the United States, which is rising. And by that I mean groups from one ethnic minority marrying groups from other ethnic minorities. In Judaism, it would be the kind of Jewish, non-Jewish intermarriage rate has been pretty steady among most ethnic minorities. It's somewhere between 30 and 50%, except for African Americans, where the inter-ethnic marriage between African Americans, meaning blacks marrying whites, is much lower than that. But until the 1960s, there were still some states where that was actually illegal. So what's happening as a result of that's one factor. And the other factor is that I think that in general, Americans have begun to identify themselves as something other than part of an ethnic group. And the result of that is a certain kind of multi-ethnicity or post-ethnicity, meaning that it doesn't mean that ethnic identification no longer exists. It still does exist, but it's increasingly no longer the primary way that that Americans identify. There was a book that was written in, I think, around 1990 by David Hollinger, who's a cultural theorist and historian at the University of California, Berkeley, called Post-Ethnic America. And he was the first to really try to describe and analyze this kind of post-ethnic turn.
So when we talk about post-ethnic, you know, the title of your book kind of hammers it, American Post-Judaism, Identity Renewal in a Post-Ethnic Society. Does that mean that Jews won't be Jewish?
Well, that's a good question. I think a lot of it has to do with the definition of what that means. I think that Jewishness as something defined exclusively by ethnicity or by biology, meaning whether you are born of a Jewish mother or, according to the Reform understanding of it, whether you're one of your parents are Jewish. I think that will probably remain the predominant model. However, I think that what's happening is that people are starting to experiment with that. I think religious syncretism, people adopting different religious practices, experimenting with different religious practices and kind of integrating it into their Jewish practice. And this is largely the result of the New Age religion phenomenon that began in the 1970s and kind of the next generation of people. So you have a certain kind of widening of the boundaries of the notion of Jewishness. And, you know, it used to be in some way that Jewishness was more tied to religion and the Jewish practice. But in America, that's not been the case for a very long time. Most Jews in America don't identify as Jews because of their religious practice. They identify with Jews because of their ethnicity. I think the book challenges its reader to think about what it would mean to think and talk and describe and even examine the notions of Jewishness when ethnicity is no longer the primary way that many Americans identify themselves, and that would include Jews. I mean, many people who are Jews, if you ask them, you know, if you ask a person in the street on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, a Eastern European Jewish immigrant, if you went up to him and you asked him, you know, who are you, the first thing he would say was, I'm a Jew. If you ask somebody on the Upper West Side, a Jew on the Upper West Side today in 2013, you know, who are you, they might not say, the first thing they might not say would be they would be a Jew. That may be the third thing they would say or the fourth thing they would say, but it might not be the first thing they would say.
Right.
So it's really a question of how individuals choose to identify themselves and kind of challenging us to think more creatively about the ways in which we can deal with that very complex shift in American culture.
We will talk much more with Professor Shaul Magid about the whole question of what creates Jewish identity today when we come back on To Jewish. Among my most pleasant, at least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my own grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the totality of the Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know of anyone who might qualify for the 2013 Kohan Award, just visit our website, www.kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N, and you'll find the nomination form to submit. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N-A-W-A-R-D. It's a good visit.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can stream past and present shows through the website or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our Mivi Na'an Israel, the head of the Weintraub Israel Center, Ashlicha Oshrat Barel. Boker Tov, good morning.
Boker Tov, good morning.
So the Prime Minister of Israel, Bibi Netanyahu, spoke at the UN last week, and he made a big splash, although I don't think it was well received in America or at the UN, but that's really not who he was speaking to, was it?
Yeah, it sounds like he spoke to Israelis. And as an Israeli, I can say that on one hand, I was very happy to hear him speak like firmly, like he will defend Israel, whatever it will take, and even if it will be, you know, Israel defend herself. But on the other hand, I wish he will leave more room for the diplomatic efforts and not just too little. That's what I heard in his speech.
You know, it's very interesting. He said, Israel will stand alone if it has to, mm-hmm. which was a message that Israel has been at pains internationally to say, you know, we have the support of America. We're also defending all the civilized world. This was a variation. He spent something like 30 minutes of a 32-33 minute speech talking about Iran.
Mm-hmm.
I would assume that the Israeli public shares that concern, that it's just as important an issue for Israelis as it looked like.
Yeah,
in that speech.
I think that since he, you know, he was kind of a party pooper. Everyone was like very excited by the new approach of Rouhani. So he came up with all this evidence about Rouhani, so people don't be so excited. He's not like if Ahmadinejad, as he said, he's an
a wolf in wolf's clothing.
So yeah. Rouhani is a wolf in a sheep clothing. So right. I think that he won't just people like there. Everyone will calm down and will understand that it's not like that Iran is Iran threat is over. I think that this is the big message for everyone, not just to the Israelis. And of course, to the Israelis, just to show a leadership that he will, you know, he will defend his country and his people, whatever it will take.
It was interesting. One of the reports was, you know, a liberal paper or a moderate paper in Israel, Yedioth mm-hmm. Ahronot, mm-hmm. which is, I don't know, it's wrong to call it the USA Today of Israel, but it's kind of the most, the circulated popular. General mm-hmm. popular paper. And they've been very critical of mm-hmm. Netanyahu. And they said, this is not the printing mistake. We think Netanyahu showed integrity in his speech or something like that. When Israelis speak abroad, often they're speaking for a domestic audience too.
Mm-hmm.
Are Israelis aware of that when they hear their leaders speaking elsewhere?
Yeah, of course. Do you mean like if they were aware that Netanyahu mostly speak to them?
Yeah.
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 I guess.
It's very interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Oshrat. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back on To Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, just returned from, I know this will shock everyone, more travels, this time to Europe again, to a number of weddings. Good morning, Tom. Welcome back.
Good morning, Rabbi. Yes, I had a marathon of weddings, back-to-back, Saturday night in Istanbul, Sunday afternoon in Belgrade, and then a few days respite before one in Vienna. And interestingly, each of the weddings was a civil ceremony, but each of the weddings involved at least one member of the couple, bride or groom, who defined themselves as being Jewish or half Jewish or having a Jewish father or a Jewish mother. And it raised a number of questions once again about who or what is a Jew, a subject of infinite complexity and a subject about which I think there's an infinite variety of opinions.
And very topical. The Pew survey just came out this week talking about how there's more Jews, but they're less connected. Very high rates of intermarriage, over 60% since the year 2000 in Jewish weddings and so on.
Right. And that, I mean, that interestingly focused on the U.S. And I think actually there's a difference between the American situation in this regard and the European situation. And at the risk of oversimplifying or making a caricature about the difference, I think that Americans are less concerned with anti-Semitism in their lives and more comfortable admitting that they're Jewish or claiming to be Jewish without really doing anything to manifest that Jewishness in terms of either religious observance, or affiliation with Jewish institutions, or active engagement in Jewish communal life. They assert their Jewishness because of being culturally Jewish, in quotation marks, whatever that may mean, or because they eat bagels and lox.
Or they like Jewish comedians or
right.
something.
Whereas in Europe, where there's an acute awareness of anti-Semitism, I think increasingly people who have a Jewish parent, regardless of whether it's mother or father, have in many cases, lost family members in the Holocaust. Anti-Semitism is in their very backyards. It's in their political life. It's an everyday phenomenon. And yet they are sort of proud to say, in an odd sort of way, I'm Jewish and participate in the Maccabi Games, or I represent my country's team in Israel on playing tennis, or they assert their Jewishness and affiliate in some way, even if they're not, according to Israeli law or traditional halakha, they're not fully Jewish.
It's a fascinating subject, and one that I'm sure we'll be talking about for a long time, both in Europe and here. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service, a modern classic. Irwin and Murray celebrate selling their garment business by going on safari to Africa. One night in the jungle, they freeze in their tracks when they hear an ominous low roar. Murray, quakes Irwin.
I heard.
Shaw, look behind me. Tell me, what do you see? A lion, a tiger, a leopard? I should know, moans Murray. What am I, a furrier? Yes, that was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week, we read the Torah portion of Lech Lecha, which includes God's great commandment to Abram, Lech Lecha me'artzacha me'ulatetcha u'mibeit avicha. Leave, go from your country and your homeland and the house of your father to a land that I will show you. It is the beginning of monotheism, of the belief in one and only one God. It's the beginning of Judaism, and it will prove to be the beginning of our connection to the land of Israel as well, a dramatic and powerful moment. The fascinating thing about Lech Lecha is not that God commands Abram, later to be renamed Abraham, to leave everything he has known. After all, if he is to create a new religion and remake belief in our world, he will need to leave polytheism and a pagan society that doesn't recognize the concept of supreme justice and divine power, a corrupt, dishonest, and ethically failed civilization. If you want to live a life of goodness and blessing, sometimes you need to leave home to do it. So Abraham picked up and left the sophisticated, morally challenged city-states of Babylon. He journeyed outward to find God and to found a new religion. That journey of differentiation was pivotal to all human history. If Abraham doesn't just do what God commands, there is no Judaism, or Christianity, or Islam, or monotheism, or Western civilization, for that matter. But what's most fascinating about Abraham's actions in this week's Torah portion of Lech Lecha is that, after God commanded him to go, he simply went, without argument or controversy. This strikes me as a very un-Jewish approach. After all, the essence of Jewish culture seems to be argument and discussion. If you were directed to leave everything you had ever known and told to move somewhere unspecified, wouldn't you at least complain a little bit? And don't think for a moment that Abraham is incapable of arguing with God. In fact, he proves in next week's Torah portion that he will argue and bargain with God to the last degree, as he does, trying to defend the few righteous people of Sodom and Gomorrah. No, something else is at work here, the essential understanding that sometimes you just have to move on, leave what you know, and embrace the journey. In order to fully realize who we can become, we must leave who we have been. It's an exciting, exhilarating, daunting prospect, dangerous, yet essential. But if we can choose to take the first steps, we, like Abraham, will reap rich rewards. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Shaul Magid, will explain just what it means to be Jewish in 21st century America and why it isn't that much like what it meant in earlier generations. Find out why and who's moving it forward when we come back on To Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Well, perhaps things won't turn out so well with Iran, at least according to Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu's speech at the UN General Assembly last week. With the newly elected Iranian President Hassan Rouhani leading a full-throttle charm offensive in New York, Bibi turned his attack on the Iranian leader himself. The Israeli Prime Minister mentioned Rouhani 25 times in the first 24 minutes of his speech, mostly calling him a dissembling servant of a violent, oppressive regime. Or as Netanyahu put it, Ahmadinejad was a wolf in wolf's clothing, while Rouhani is a wolf in sheep's clothing. Rouhani wants to have his yellow cake and eat it too. Bibi also juxtaposed Iran's savage record with Rouhani's soothing rhetoric. Netanyahu devoted 30 minutes of his 33-minute speech to Iran. While Israel is now in peace talks with the Palestinians, and Syria is using chemical weapons on its own citizens, and Egypt is a mess again, Bibi focused solely on Iran. The note that Netanyahu hit the hardest was that Israel would stand alone if it had to against Iran, which can't be considered good news for those who care about the U.S.-Israel alliance. Clearly aimed as a shot at President Obama, whose initiative on Syria somehow turned into a Russian fig leaf for the murderous Bashar Assad regime, Netanyahu basically said that Israel is willing to attack Iran to stop its nuclear efforts, whether or not America supports it. It was an interesting, slightly scary change in what he has said until now. However, it struck a strong domestic chord in Israel itself, where Yedioth Ahronot, an anti-BB newspaper, wrote in an editorial that his UN speech, he seemed, and this is not a printing mistake, trustworthy. While we are sort of on the subject of Russia, apparently someone has now nominated Vladimir Putin, the colorful, brutal dictator, or president of Russia, for the Nobel Peace Prize, because he averted a Western attack on Syria, and he got Assad to give up some of his chemical weapons to be destroyed. The Nobel Committee says the nomination comes too late for this year's award, which is good news, frankly. It's a weird world, isn't it? And Jewish lobbying group J Street concluded a hugely successful fourth national conference of 3,000 attendees in Washington that included talks by Vice President Joe Biden and Chief Israeli Peace Negotiator Tzipi Livni. And oh, by the way, the government shut down, but nobody cared. There is a new Jewish voice at the Capitol, J Street, and while AIPAC continues to have huge influence, it is also clear that J Street's continues to grow. And in a major story from the birthplace of democracy, Jewish leaders came out strongly in favor of Greece's crackdown last week by anti-terror forces on the leadership of the neo-Nazi Golden Dawn Party, which resulted in the incarceration of several senior party members, including leader Nikolaos Mihaloliakos. The arrests, which are the most significant crackdown on a political party in Greece since the fall of its military dictatorship way back in 1974, are the biggest setback to Golden Dawn since it entered Greek parliament on an anti-immigrant agenda last year. Ranked as Greece's third most popular party, Golden Dawn is under investigation for the murder of rapper Pavlos Fissas, who bled to death after being stabbed twice by a party sympathizer last week. The party has denied any links to the killing. Last week's raids saw the arrests of Mihaloliakos, party spokesman Ilias Kassidiaris, three other lawmakers, and 13 party members of Golden Dawn, while the party's number two, Christos Pappas, turned himself in to police in Athens. The detainees were taken under high security to the prosecutor's office, charged officially on evidence linking the party with a string of attacks, including the stabbing of the rapper and the killing of an immigrant earlier this year. Golden Dawn is noted for its activity against immigrants. Calling Golden Dawn a criminal organization, Public Order Minister Nikos Dendias stated that the investigation will not end, implying that a wider crackdown is in the works. After the rapper's murder, Dendias proposed legislation that would cut off state funding to parties if their leader or more than a tenth of their lawmakers were charged with a felony carrying a 10-year jail term. Until this week's crackdown, the government of Prime Minister Antonis Samaras had resisted calls to ban the party in Greece. Golden Dawn has been called anti-Semitic by many members of the Greek administration. As Jews, we are very happy about the arrest, Benjamin Albalas, head of the Central Board of Jewish Communities in Greece, said. This group, I don't call them a party, is a neo-Nazi group. I think that the government will go until the end with them. David Saltiel, a former president of that organization, said the Golden Dawn is not a political party, but a gang. The Jewish community always said that the Golden Dawn was a Nazi party, and the government has to be aware. What is happening is incredible. The government is showing resolve in eliminating this neo-Nazi party. It's the first time the Greek government has shown this determination in reestablishing order in Greek society. Sabe Mionis, a Greek-Israeli financier who has been under fire by Golden Dawn for refusing to testify before a Greek parliament that he said contained Holocaust deniers, said, "Either they will ban Golden Dawn or dismantle it, one way or the other, but Golden Dawn as we knew it is over for good." We can certainly hope so. In less good news from Europe, a resolution that calls male ritual circumcision, Brit Milah, a violation of the physical integrity of children was passed overwhelmingly by the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. The Council, a pan-European intergovernmental organization, debated and passed the resolution last week based on a report by the Committee on Social Affairs, Health and Sustainable Development, led by German reporter Marlene Ruprecht. The resolution passed by a vote of 78-13 with 15 abstentions. It called on states to clearly define the medical, sanitary, and other conditions to be ensured for practices such as the non-medically justified circumcision of young boys. Definitely stop short of banning it, however. While most see this as a response to fears of the rising Muslim population in Europe, the effect on Brit Milah is obvious. We will apparently continue to see further efforts to limit circumcision in Europe. Distressing. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. Our brothers, We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Professor Shaul Magid. He's at Indiana University with its outstanding Judaic Studies program. His book is called American Post-Judaism, Identity and Renewal in a Post-Ethnic Society. One of the areas in which you see room for fertile growth in the American Jewish community or for further development in Jewish identity is the renewal movement. That's provoked some controversy and some responses. Talk a little bit about how you view the renewal movement, actually what the renewal movement really is.
Just to begin, American Jewry has been basically divided according to denominations. That's kind of, in a way, the American Jewish community has modeled itself very much along the lines of Protestant Christianity. So
right.
You have, these denominations of Orthodoxy, Reform, Conservative, Orthodoxy, and Reconstruction Judaism. For most of American Jewish history, the Reform movement was the largest movement. It still is in the new Pew poll that came out just a couple of weeks ago. About 30 or 35% of American Jews identify as Reform. So you have this kind of denominational structure. And I think what's happening is that over the last 15 or 20 years, that denominational structure is beginning to dissipate, but it's beginning to kind of shift. So Jewish renewal basically it's a movement that's an outgrowth of Judaism, traditional Judaism meeting the New Age. So back in the 1960s, there was this individual, Damas Shakti Shalomi, who now lives in Boulder, Colorado, who basically comes from a Hasidic background, a pre-war Hasidic background. And
he was a Chabadnik for a while, actually.
He was Chabad for a while. I mean, he grew up in Austria and then later spent time in Belgium, and he was in a DP camp in France, and he became part of Chabad when he came to the United States. And then subsequently left Chabad. And what happened is, you have this kind of real counterculture that emerges in the 1960s, identity politics, the counterculture. And there were a number of different Jews who became very involved with that, people who were already adults in their 20s and 30s, Amos Shechter Shalomi, Shlomo Kalbach, and a number of other people. And as a result of that kind of merging of the New Age and traditional Judaism, you had a number of different movements. One movement called the Chabura movement, which was basically a kind of lay-led experimental synagogue that was simply a kind of think tank for Jewish ritual experimentation. Now, the Chabura movement eventually began in a number of different places. You had the original Chabura Shalom in Somerville, Massachusetts. You had the House of Love and Prayer and later the Aquarian Union in Berkeley. And then you had the Manhattan Chabura in Manhattan. So in these kind of main centers where many of the Jewish young people were, you have these movements that are kind of grassroots Jewish experimental movements, which are countercultural in nature, involved in all kinds of political movements, whether it was against the war, whether it was against feminism, and they begin to kind of construct a new format for Jewish worship. This eventually becomes Jewish renewal a little bit later, probably in the late 70s. And the Jewish renewal movement is an attempt, and I think this is the point of the book, attempt to see that we're living, especially in the post-Holocaust world, in what Shakti Shalomi calls a new paradigm. And that new paradigm demands an entire reframing and rethinking and restructuring of Judaism as lived and practiced. So it's not simply about accommodation to an American environment, accommodation to assimilation, or accommodation to any particular movement, for example, feminism. But it's really rethinking at the roots what Judaism is and what it can be. And to a large degree, it's really modeled after the Hasidic movement that emerges in the late 18th century in Eastern Europe, which these Jewish renewal people kind of use as their kind of radical base. And they offer a kind of New Age interpretation of Hasidism as a kind of rebellious movement against the status quo. And I think that's what renewal is trying to do. One of the things that's important to note is that renewal doesn't see itself as another Jewish denomination. or it doesn't want to see itself as such, to add to the four denominations that already exist. It wants to see itself in some way as an instantiation of a post-denominational Judaism. Now, it's gotten a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of criticism for all kinds of reasons, because it's understood to be non-normative, to be flaky, to be a little bit, you know, kind of new agey. And so there's a lot of criticism. But I think the truth of the matter is that it's had a tremendous impact on all the Jewish denominations. For example, Jewish meditation as a practice that's done and studied by Orthodox Jews, by Conservative Jews, by Reform Jews, by Reconstructionist Jews, Jewish meditation is something that was really introduced by Jewish renewal. The interest in Buddhism and the kind of Jewish Buddhist movement also. So in many ways, or even the lay-led independent Minyan movement that's happening now is really in some way a child of the Chaburah movement and Jewish renewal. So I think that Jewish renewal as a movement is fairly small, self-select group of people, but I think its tentacles really spread out into the entire American Jewish landscape.
You know, it has always seemed to me that the influence of new areas of Jewish work tend to be much broader than the movements that they spawn. Reconstructionist Judaism changed Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox Judaism much more dramatically than it did create many, many large institutions on its own. You know, you could say we're all Reconstructionist Jews based on the way that synagogues offer all kinds of programming that used to not even be part of the mentality of Jews relating to a synagogue. The renewal movements had a profound influence, but so have some other things like, I hate to mention it, but like the Kabbalah Center, who have made it sort of okay for people to look at mysticism. How does this relate to the concept of a post-ethnic Judaism?
Well, that's a good question. And the Kabbalah Center is actually very important. I mean, it really is an important piece to the puzzle, because if you think about, you know, what have been some of the most influential Jewish movements in the last 25 or 30 years, I think that you might, in America, I think that it would be, one could arguably say the Kabbalah Center, Chabad, and Jewish renewal. In terms of these movements that are not part of religious denominations, are willing to kind of speak across denominational lines and have had a tremendous influence. I mean, Chabad has had a tremendous influence on American Judaism. And I think the Kabbalah Center has as well. I mean, even given its own proclivities and given its own, I think, again, since non-normative way of doing things, especially back, I mean, you know, Philip Berg, who was the founder of the Kabbalah Center, just passed away a couple of weeks ago. When I was kind of coming of age in the early 70s, I mean, a lot of people in the Orthodox world that I came from were reading Philip Berg's translations of Kabbalah. Right. So he, in the 70s, he was actually quite influential. I mean, it became a little bit less so once the Kabbalah Center phenomenon started, but he's an important piece. So how are these things post-ethnic? Well, I think one of the, and this speaks specifically to the Kabbalah Center and renewal, and again, I don't think that they're tied together, but I think there are some similarities. I think one of the things that they're doing, which is post-ethnic, is that they are opening up Judaism to non-Jews. Now, not only not opening up Judaism to non-Jews as a path to conversion to Judaism. I mean, that's been done for centuries. But they're basically presenting Judaism as a world religion, in a sense. That is to say that Judaism has a wisdom, and Judaism has a tradition, a textual tradition, a spiritual tradition, a devotional tradition, that actually has something to offer the world. And it's not simply there to service Jews. Now, the Kabbalah Center is more open to non-Jews being an integral part of their community. I think Jewish Renewal is still primarily a community of Jews, but they are very open to non-Jewish practices that become integrated into their religious life. And they're also more and more open to non-Jews being members of their community. I think that's an incredibly important thing, especially when you think of the fact that the intermarriage rate among non-Orthodox Jews, according to this Pew poll, the intermarriage rate of American Jews among the non-Orthodox is about 70%. So you have a lot of non-Jewish spouses who are married to Jews. And the traditional you know, the traditional kind of model is that the non-Jew marries that the Jew marries a non-Jew, and then is kind of lost to the kind of American, you know, American society. But increasingly, these intermarried couples, the Jewish partner is continuing to be a member of the community and is becoming more an active member of the community, in part because of the non-Jewish spouse. And the non-Jewish spouse is no longer interested in converting, because in a multiculturalist world, why should you convert? You have your own tradition, you have your own, you know, you have your own narrative that you want to own. But yet they do want to become part of the Jewish community. So I think all religious denominations, except Orthodoxy, where the intermarriage rate is very low, but all other religious denominations are really having to deal with how do you integrate the non-Jew into the Jewish community. And I think that renewal in particular is being very experimental in rethinking not only, yes, we'll let you come to the synagogue or let you be a member of the synagogue, but we can actually integrate you as a non-Jew into religious practice. That's something new.
When we talk about a non-ethnic Judaism or a post-Judaism in which Jewish identity is related, as you say in your book, to Torah study and social action, but they can be practiced by non-Jews, you know, that presents a certain threat to everything we've thought of as institutional Judaism. Are those institutions therefore destined to disappear?
I don't think that they're destined to disappear. I think that those institutions have to really begin to think much more creatively about what's actually happening rather than try to stem the tide of what's actually happening. I think that for a long time, the large institutions, conservative Judaism and Reform Judaism, in particular Reconstructionism is less so, but have been trying to actually reverse this the shifting sands of Jewish identity, and I think that that's not, in my mind, a very productive way to go. I mean, I was a professor at the Jewish Theological Seminary of the Conservative Movement for 7 years, and very, very much a part of that institution. I think that more and more these institutions are beginning to think about the fact that the intermarriage rates in America among Jews and non-Jews are not going to go down in any significant way, even though a lot of money is being thrown into things like Birthright Israel and so on to try to stem the tide of intermarriage. It doesn't seem to be working. That part of it doesn't seem to be working. So it really, you know, each institution is really defined by its own ideology and its own and its own inclinations. But I think that in this way, I think that renewal, although it's small and somewhat insignificant when you think of the entire population, is really ahead of the curve in creatively thinking about how to respond to the changing environment, as opposed to trying to change what the changing environment.
I want to thank Shaul Magid for a great visit here on Too Jewish. His book is called American Post-Judaism, Identity and Renewal in a Post-Ethnic Society, available, like everything, on Amazon. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical playout on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday morning at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Professor Tzvi Eckstein, explaining why Jews seem to be smarter and more successful today and how it relates to Jewish education throughout history. Our playout this morning is another version of Quando Re Nimrod, the great Sephardic song about Abraham, our father. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.